2001 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium. Session 252. How Long, O Lord? Constitutional Protection for Plural Marriage. Participants L. Rex Sears and Mary P. Batchelor.
Number 252. How Long, O Lord? Constitutional Protection for Plural Marriage. Our paper is by L. Rex Sears, attorney here in Salt Lake. He got his degree in philosophy, a PhD, no less, from Harvard, and then switched to the University of Chicago for his JD degree. Published books and articles. I'm not quite sure, but there's several there. Determinist Mormons in the Mormon House, Dialogue, Philosophical Christian Apostasy Meets Rational Mormon Theology, a Dialogue article. And the last one, something that the Saints for their Peculiar Institution, the Utah Law Review. The respondent today is Bill Morrison, who's filling in for his daughter. And Bill, again, was one of these peculiar creatures who gets a degree in one thing and then goes to law. He received his degree, a master's in education, and then he got his law degree from Western State University in California. With that kind of introduction, I'll sit down and let the program begin.
Let me begin with a quick word about the motivation for this paper. Can you hear me? No? Yes? Yeah. Okay. Speak loud. Okay, I can do that. But then I can't fiddle with my papers. That's an awful thought. That's right. Quick word about what this paper is and is not supposed to accomplish. Basically, there are two objectives for the paper. One is just a matter of public education. With the Tom Green case recently in the news, I suspect that there may be some people for whom polygamy is of occasional interest, whose interest has been recently re-sparked. And one question that it's natural to ask is, given the development of constitutional jurisprudence over the past century or so, where all sorts of different groups have been receiving all sorts of constitutional protections, why haven't those sorts of protections reached polygamists? And a second purpose is, apart from the public education goal, to just to make my own prediction for where things might be headed. So, with that preface, let me begin. The Utah Code currently provides, quote, a person is guilty of bigamy when, knowing he has a husband or wife, or knowing the other person has a husband or wife, the person purports to marry another person or cohabits with another person. Note that it's framed in terms of both marriage and cohabitation. Bigamy, as defined by the statute, is a felony. The Utah Constitution, in turn, provides that, quote, polygamous or plural marriages are forever prohibited, and that's in a provision that is, quote, irrevocable without the consent of the United States and the people of this state. This paper explores constitutional defenses that have been or may be tried by polygamous Mormons to avoid punishment for violating these and comparable statutes. As I said in the program abstract, on the predictive side, the ironic conclusion is that Mormon fundamentalists might do best to throw in with gay rights activists, because the best constitutional argument for polygamy seems to be the same argument that homosexuals make to combat anti-sodomy legislation that renders homosexual activities illegal. As I mentioned in the abstract, this is going to be both a historical and a legal perspective on the constitutional issues, so we'll start off with a historical perspective that develops the first of the legal arguments. In August 1852, the church held a special conference to announce publicly what the rest of the nation already knew, that the Mormons practiced plural marriage. By assignment, Orson Pratt delivered the central address. One of Pratt's most important objectives was establishing a legal defense for the practice. Sensibly, he turned to the First Amendment of the Federal Constitution, which in pertinent part reads, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or," and this is the key clause, "prohibiting the free exercise thereof." These are referred to as the Establishment and Free Exercise Clauses of the First Amendment. Pratt reasoned that because the Mormons practiced polygamy out of religious conviction, the practice was protected by the Free Exercise Clause. This is probably the most appealing and tantalizing of the arguments I will be considering today, but not, I think, the most promising. Pratt was more of a mathematician than a lawyer, and he made the argument in a way that was doomed to fail. Pratt thought that the applicability of the First Amendment turned on whether polygamy was an integral, as opposed to merely incidental, part of Mormonism. So Pratt argued that polygamy was indeed an essential part of Mormonism and that Mormons, in fact, considered polygamy to be a prerequisite to salvation. But as the courts have expressly recognized since Pratt's time, the First Amendment forbids governmental inquiry into whether a teaching is central or peripheral. The only permissible inquiries for a court to make are whether actors claim religious sanction for their conduct and whether that claim is sincere. If a religion claims a doctrine as part of its creed, and that assertion is not shown to be insincere, courts can investigate no further because the very investigation into the proper place of a given doctrine within the religious system would be a constitutionally impermissible interference with religion. That is, in order for a court or any other government entity to get in there and say, well, this doctrine falls closer to the periphery or closer to the court, that would in and of itself be impermissible government intervention. Of course, subsequent events have shown that the free exercise argument was doomed to fail, however it was made. The greatest challenge facing the argument is that religion cannot shield every practice from state regulation. Consider three examples. In some cultures, religious duty is thought to demand the painful circumcision of young women. In other cultures, religion has been thought to require that a wife be burned on her husband's funeral pyre, preferably voluntarily, but if not voluntarily, then by force. And in 19th century Mormonism, it appears that apostasy was sometimes punishable by private execution. Under the Constitution, if the state tolerates mutilation or murder sanctioned by one religion, then it must excuse every religiously motivated act of the same kind, because the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment does not permit preferential treatment for one religion over another. So the free exercise guaranteed by the First Amendment must have limits. Religious exercise is no different than any other right guaranteed by the Constitution in that respect. Even freedom of speech and of the press, also guaranteed by the First Amendment, has limits. By way of illustration, if I incite a mob to lynch a man, I can be tried and convicted for causing his death, First Amendment protections of free speech notwithstanding. Been one or two good Law and Order episodes on that sort of thing. Free exercise must have limits. The trick is identifying them. The Morrill Act expressly criminalized polygamy in 1862 in federal territories, and that law gave the Supreme Court its first opportunity to consider the limits on free exercise in Reynolds v. United States, decided in 1878. The court found that, quote, "laws are made for the government of actions, and while they cannot interfere with mere religious belief and opinions, they may with practices." In short, under the reasoning of Reynolds, religious opinions are protected, but actions taken in accordance with those opinions are not. Now, this immediately raises a puzzle that we'll be revisiting here shortly, and that is, if the First Amendment only protects religious opinions, why refer to free exercise? Exercise apparently connotes something more than just an opinion or the expression of it. We'll get back to that. To fully understand the Reynolds opinion and the cases that follow it, the issue must be properly framed. The First Amendment does not permit Congress to pass legislation favoring or targeting a specific religion. As an example, in Church of the Lukumi Babalu IA, probably butchered that badly, v. City of Hialeah, a case decided in 1993, a city council targeted the Santeria practice of animal sacrifice. Now, the trick was the city council wanted to ban the Santeria sacrifices, but not Jewish kosher practices. So the council enacted a tortured patchwork of municipal ordinances that the Supreme Court characterized as a religious gerrymander, and the court struck down the legislation. Legislators cannot narrowly target a particular religion. The issue considered by the Supreme Court first in Reynolds and subsequently in other cases is whether and how general laws are to be applied in cases where religious convictions are pled as justification for violating those laws in particular instances. Thus, the court held that held the Morrill Act, quote, constitutional and valid as prescribing a rule of action for all those residing in the territories and in places over which the United States have exclusive control. Just by way of a quick explanatory side note for those of you who are not familiar with this, in our country, there are certain, the states are said to have more or less plenary police power. The states can pretty much regulate what they want, but the ability of the federal government to regulate is limited by the Constitution. And however, when you're talking about a territory, which Utah was at the time, as opposed to a state, the federal government stands in place of the state government, and the federal government can legislate on anything it wants. A general federal law regulating marriage in the states would violate constitutional limits on the federal government's power. So that the wording here is important when the court talks about a rule of action for those residing in the territories and in places over which the United States have exclusive control, that is, exclusive of state government. Granted, the act was directed at the Mormons, but it was nevertheless general in application and in conformity with statutory and common law principles that were generally prevalent elsewhere in the country. That's what makes it different from the patchwork of ordinances I was describing earlier. These are general ordinances that apply to everybody, and moreover, they conform with general, consistent patterns of both statutory and common law regulations nationwide. The act was not a gerrymander that prohibited Mormon plural marriage while countenancing polygamous unions by people of other faiths. The Reynolds Court found that general laws must always trump religious convictions. Quote, can a man excuse his practices to the contrary because of his religious belief? To permit this would be to make the professed doctrines of religious belief superior to the law of the land, and in effect, to permit every citizen to become a law unto himself. Government could exist only in name under such circumstances. So the Supreme Court was concerned that if you allow the religious justification, you're not going to be able to enforce the laws at all because everybody's going to interpose the religious justification for whatever they do. All legislation is subject to judicial scrutiny under the rational basis test. That is, all legislation must serve some legitimate governmental purpose. But according to Reynolds, where a rational basis exists for the general law, religious convictions cannot justify disobedience in a particular case. And as you may recall, I was saying a few minutes ago that that is how the issue needs to be understood. What effect does a religious belief have on the enforcement of a general law? And Reynolds says, as long as the general law has some rational basis, the religious conviction has no effect. Moving forward to 1940, the Supreme Court seemingly acknowledged that the Free Exercise Clause must also reach at least some conduct. In Cantwell v. Connecticut, Jehovah's Witness Newton Campbell was convicted of disturbing the peace by playing a record that denounced Catholicism in a predominantly Catholic neighborhood. The court reversed his conviction on multiple constitutional grounds and along the way made this remark. The constitutional inhibition of legislation on the subject of religion has a double aspect. On the one hand, it forestalls compulsion by law of the acceptance of any creed or the practice of any form of worship. freedom of conscience, and freedom to adhere to such religious organization or form of worship as the individual may choose cannot be restricted by law. On the other hand, it safeguards the free exercise of the chosen form of religion. Thus, and here's the important part, the amendment embraces two concepts, freedom to believe and freedom to act. However, Cantwell still recognized that religious conduct did not and could not enjoy the same level of protection as religious belief. Quote, the first is absolute, but in the nature of things, the second cannot be. Conduct remains subject to regulation for the protection of society. Now, that having been said, in the 1960s and 1970s, the court briefly flirted with a higher degree of protection for religious conduct that violated general laws. In Sherbert v. Verner, a 1963 case, a Seventh-day Adventist had been discharged for refusing to work on Sundays. Fired, that is. The state of South Carolina refused to pay unemployment benefits because Ms. Sherbert had declined suitable work without what the state recognized as good cause. Instead of merely requiring the state to show that it had a rational basis for its general law, however, the court held that because Ms. Sherbert's refusal to work Sundays grew out of her religious convictions, the state had to meet a higher standard and had to show a compelling interest in applying its admittedly reasonable general law to the particular facts before it. That is, the court found that it was not enough for the state to justify its law in general terms. The state had to show why the state had a compelling interest in enforcing the law in this particular case. Because the state could not do so, the court found that the state could not deny unemployment benefits to Ms. Sherbert. Again, in Wisconsin v. Yoder, an Amish man was convicted for failure to send his 15-year-old daughter to school after she had completed eighth grade, as required by Wisconsin state law, which required school attendance until the age of 16. The father based his refusal on his religious community's belief that high school attendance would jeopardize his daughter's salvation by exposing her to worldly influences and improper emphases on intellectual accomplishment, self-distinction, competitiveness, and worldly success. I think the view that high school attendance can jeopardize your daughter's salvation goes beyond the Amish community. The court again applied the compelling interest standard as opposed to the lower rational basis standard and struck down Mr. Yoder's conviction. But the revolution marked by Sherbert and Yoder proved to be narrow in scope and short-lived. Finally, in 1990, Justice Antonin Scalia formally erased the compelling interest standard from free exercise jurisprudence. In Employment Division v. Smith, a 1990 case, two Native Americans were fired for ingesting peyote during Native American church ceremonies in violation of an Oregon state law banning possession of controlled substances. And because the men were fired for breaking that law, they were denied unemployment benefits. So again, as in the Sherbert case, what you have is the state applying its general unemployment laws to a case where the conduct that led to the firing was religiously motivated. The defendants argued that because they had interposed their religious convictions as a defense, the state had to show a compelling interest in applying its admittedly rational general law to their particular situations. The Supreme Court rejected the argument, finding that in earlier cases, the application of the compelling interest standard as opposed to the rational basis standard was justified because rights other than the free exercise of religion were involved in those earlier cases. Cantwell involved free speech, and Yoder involved parental direction of a child's educational career. Sherbert was a little bit more troubling. It was characterized as a narrow, dead letter, inapplicable in Smith because the conduct at issue in Smith was the subject of a criminal statute. The woman in Sherbert hadn't violated any laws by not working Sunday. These guys had violated a criminal statute. Smith compels the conclusion that the rule established by Reynolds is alive and well, and that so long as the state can show a rational basis for a general law, religious conviction cannot excuse or justify any particular actor's violation of that general law. But there are some interesting questions to ask about the modern scope of Reynolds in light of legislative events that followed the 1878 decision. Now, the 1862 Morrill Act, the first piece of federal legislation that criminalized polygamy in Utah Territory, made it a crime for a person with a living spouse to marry another. prosecution under the Act was complicated by the fact that it could be difficult to prove both marriages, especially because a wife could not be compelled to testify against her husband until the 1887 Edmunds-Tucker Act abrogated that testimonial immunity. Starting with the Edmunds Act of 1882, later legislation accordingly introduced the new and easier to prosecute criminal offense of cohabitation, roughly defined as carrying on as if you're married. The current Utah anti-bigamy statute that I quoted at the outset continues to recognize the distinction, specifically reciting both marriage and both a second marriage and cohabitation as crimes. So it now makes because of the legislation subsequent to the Morrill Act and subsequent to the Reynolds decision, because that legislation introduced a distinction between bigamy and cohabitation, it makes legal sense to speak of marriage separate and apart from acting like a married person. That is, there's having a marriage, and then there's acting like you're married to the person. And it seems that marriage, apart from cohabitation, might fall into the realm of opinion rather than conduct, and so might be immune from regulation. That is, if I participate in a religious ceremony that I characterize as a marriage ceremony, as a result of which I consider myself to have entered into a second marriage, and I believe that God recognizes this second marriage, I have not yet moved over into the realm of conduct and permissible state regulation. The person performing the ceremony has said some words, and I have formed a certain belief, but I have not done anything. So even under Reynolds, the contraction of a second marriage in a religious ceremony should be beyond the reach of the state. Of course, if I try to obtain a second marriage certificate from the civil authorities, I have crossed the line by seeking state recognition. But so long as I do not seek state sanction or some sort of benefit such as tax breaks that I understand are supposed to be available to married people, I haven't really seen or appreciated them myself, but if I were to try to get some sort of tax break based on the second marriage or something like that, as long as I don't do something like that, I should be immune from prosecution for the bare marriage. But because a plural marriage in name only would be at most a partial victory, it seems that the free exercise argument is a loser, or at least it doesn't get all the way to where a fundamentalist would want it to go. So let's move on to the second of three constitutional arguments I'll be considering today. This one goes under the name of equal footing, and it's based on the fact that all states are supposed to have the same footing once they enter the Union. When Utah was brought into the Union as a state, it was done so on condition that the state constitution incorporate a provision forever banning polygamy and a provision that is irrevocable without the consent of the United States. In Coyle v. Smith, a 1910 case, the Supreme Court found that a so-called irrevocable ordinance that purportedly deprived a state of a power that it would otherwise enjoy could not be enforced. All states, once admitted, are on an equal footing, and no irrevocable ordinance imposed as a condition of admission can alter that fact. So if marriage is within the proper scope of state regulation but not federal regulation, once Utah is admitted, Utah cannot be bound by the irrevocable ordinance. Now, in Potter v. Murray City, the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals, and that's the court that occupies the middle tier in the judicial system between the Federal District Court here in Utah and the Supreme Court, the Tenth Circuit recognized that the Supreme Court's holding in Coyle v. Smith might indeed render the irrevocable ordinance revocable after all, without the consent of the United States. But the Tenth Circuit also identified the fatal shortcoming in any argument built just on Coyle. Coyle stands for the proposition that a state can repeal an improper irrevocable ordinance, but unless and until the ordinance is repealed, the ordinance remains in force. Coyle and Potter suggest that the legislature and populace of the sovereign state of Utah have the power to amend the state constitution to remove the irrevocable ordinance, but unless and until that happens, the ordinance remains good Utah law. So the equal footing argument enables a political solution. That is, it makes it possible, at least conceive, as a legal matter, it makes it possible to enlist the populace in the legislature to legalize polygamy. But the popular support necessary to take advantage of that fact seems to be lacking, to put it mildly. Which brings us to the third constitutional defense, which I also think is more likely than the others ultimately to succeed. In Griswold v. Connecticut, a 1965 case, the Supreme Court overturned the convictions of several doctors charged as accessories for violating a Connecticut statute that prohibited the use of contraceptive drugs and devices. The court found, quote, that specific guarantees in the Bill of Rights have penumbras formed by emanations from those guarantees that help give them life and substance. Various guarantees create zones of privacy. In other words, for the first 10 amendments of the Constitution, for the Bill of Rights to do its job effectively, there have to be some additional, basically unenumerated liberties, some privacy interest that also has to be protected in order for those amendments to do their work. Quote, without those peripheral rights, the specific rights would be less secure, end quote. In Griswold, the court found that the privacy of the marital bedroom fell within the penumbral protections of the Bill of Rights. In Griswold, the court had emphasized the privacy of the marital bedroom and the fact that the statute there at issue necessarily invaded that privacy because that statute focused not on the distribution of contraceptives, which might reasonably be considered a public activity, but rather on their use, which is unavoidably a private matter. In Eisenstadt v. Baird, a 1972 case, the Supreme Court extended the reach of Griswold. In Eisenstadt, the court struck down a Massachusetts statute that prohibited the distribution of contraceptives to unmarried people. The court reasoned that the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment prohibited dissimilar treatment for married and unmarried people, so the holding of Griswold must also protect the contraceptive rights of singles. Finally, in Roe v. Wade, notoriously, in 1973, the Supreme Court held that the penumbral right of privacy, quote, is broad enough to encompass a woman's decision whether or not to terminate her pregnancy. Recognition of a fundamental right in certain conduct does not place that conduct completely beyond state regulation, but such recognition does impose strict limits on the state's ability to regulate that conduct. Where a fundamental right is at stake, the state must show that it has used narrowly tailored means to further a compelling state interest. This is the standard that Sherbert v. Verner and Wisconsin v. Yoder held must be met for legislation that impacts the free exercise of religion. In Roe v. Wade, the court applied this standard to the context of abortion and the pertinent state interests, and I'm mentioning this just as a way of illustrating how the standard can be applied in a particular case. In Roe v. Wade, the court applied this standard and weighted against the state interests, and on that basis concluded that the state could not regulate first trimester abortion, could freely legislate with respect to third trimester abortion, and could impose some restrictions on second trimester abortion because the balancing of interests as the pregnancy progresses changes. But in Bowers v. Hardwick, a 1986 case, the Supreme Court drew the line at homosexual sodomy. In that case, Mr. Hardwick brought suit in a federal trial court seeking to have the Georgia sodomy statute declared unconstitutional as applied to consensual homosexual sodomy. Mr. Hardwick, the guy in the case, relied on Griswold v. Connecticut, Eisenstadt v. Baird, and Roe v. Wade to argue that the Constitution protected private sexual conduct in general, and consensual homosexual sodomy in particular. The trial court found against Hardwick, the Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit found for him, and the Supreme Court agreed to hear the case. Drawing on Griswold, Eisenstadt, Roe, and other precedents, the Supreme Court found that the category of fundamental rights at play in those and other cases admitted of two characterizations. That is, there's two kinds of fundamental penumbral rights protected by the Bill of Rights. First, fundamental liberties that are implicit in the concept of ordered liberty, such that neither liberty nor justice would exist if they were sacrificed. That's one option. Or two, liberties that are deeply rooted in this nation's history and tradition. Now, the court found it, quote, obvious that neither of these formulations would extend a fundamental right to homosexuals to engage in acts of consensual sodomy because prescriptions against that conduct have ancient roots. The court also expressed concern that, quote, it would be difficult to limit the claimed right to homosexual conduct while leaving exposed to prosecution adultery, incest, and other sexual crimes committed in the home. And the court said it was, quote, unwilling to start down that road. Now, Mr. Hardwick also argued that even if there were no fundamental right to engage in consensual homosexual sodomy in the privacy of the home, the Georgia statute could not survive scrutiny under the rational basis standard applicable to all legislation because the only basis for the law was the, quote, presumed belief of a majority of the electorate in Georgia that homosexual sodomy is immoral and unacceptable. The Supreme Court rejected this argument as well, noting that, quote, the law is constantly based on notions of morality, and if all laws representing essentially moral choices are to be invalidated, the courts will be very busy indeed. Now, I'm mentioning these items because they transfer over fairly directly to the plural marriage context. Again, we're dealing with prescriptions that have long genealogies, and it's rooted in moral disapprobation. Bowers was a 5-4 decision, and the vigorous dissent concluded that the Constitution does not permit government to, quote, deprive individuals of the right to choose for themselves how to conduct their intimate relationships. According to the dissent, there is an important, quote, difference between laws that protect public sensibilities and those that enforce private morality, and while the state may act to, quote, protect individuals from unwilling exposure to the sexual activities of others, end quote, it may not interfere with conduct occurring within the privacy of the home just because some, many, or most other people find that conduct morally or religiously offensive. Now, I said in the abstract, no legal background would be presupposed, so let me quickly flesh out one or two things here. Supreme Court has 9 members, and so if you get a 5-4 decision, it was a very close decision, and while it's still the law of the land, it might be more susceptible to attack. And occasionally you'll even find Supreme Court justices saying, well, yes, but that was a 5-4 decision. So it means that it was a close call in any event. And the dissent in Bowers would have protected private sexual conduct in the home. The reasoning of the Bowers dissent and majority both carry over fairly directly to the plural marriage context. And I already said that. Now, note that even the Bowers dissent said you could still legislate to protect people from public exposure to the sexual activities of others. The Bowers majority also supported its holding by noting that, quote, no connection between family, marriage, or procreation on the one hand and homosexual activity on the other has been demonstrated. It might be tempting to seize on this language to distinguish bans on homosexual conduct from prescriptions against plural marriages. But the family and marriage the court had in mind appear to be traditional families and traditional marriages. After all, on a broader reading of family and marriages, gays too could claim protection, as the minority acknowledged when it framed the ultimate issue with respect to whether the state could regulate how an individual conducts her intimate relationships. Bowers apparently holds that a sufficient basis exists for the regulation of intimate relationships other than traditional family relationships, upon no basis other than that most people find certain kinds of relationship to be morally offensive. Legislation against polygamous relationships meets the same standard and so may be prohibited as readily as homosexuality. And I'm sorry, I missed time to this thing. Briefly, a more recent case raises serious questions about the vitality of Bowers. It's a 1992 decision titled Romer v. Evans. At issue was an amendment to the Colorado State Constitution passed by referendum that would not permit gays and lesbians to get protection at local levels. The only way gays and lesbians would be able to secure protected status would be through statewide legislation, and not only that, but statewide legislation basically they'd have to amend the state constitution in order to get any sort of protection as a protected class from firing or things of that nature. A 6-member majority of the court struck down the amendment, relying on 2 findings. First, they found that the amendment impermissibly singled out homosexuals for unfavorable legal treatment by preventing them from using the political machinery of local government to achieve their legislative ends. And second, the court found that the amendment, quote, raised the inevitable inference that the disadvantage imposed is born of animosity toward the class of persons affected. Now, arguably, the most significant thing about Romer for the polygamy issue is what the dissent had to say about what the Romer majority had done. The dissent argued that the majority's decision directly contradicted Bowers, And if the dissent is right about that, given that we have a 6-3 majority in Romer, a 5-4 majority in Bowers, and a lot of turnover in court personnel in the meantime, there might be a majority of the court presently that would overrule Bowers. Did a little bit of justice counting, and we can go into that later if anyone's interested. Looks to me like there might indeed be a 5-4 majority to overrule Bowers. Now, the dissent, the other significant thing about the dissent in Romer is that it found not only that the majority's ruling ran counter to Bowers, but that it ran counter to an important polygamy case decided in 1890, namely Davis v. Beeson. At issue in that case was an Idaho territorial statute that denied the vote to anyone who not only practiced polygamy, but also anyone who advocated polygamy or belonged to an organization that advocated polygamy. The Supreme Court upheld the statute in that case. Now, Justice Scalia, who wrote the dissent, said that an implication of Davis v. Beeson is that the irrevocable ordinance is okay. Now, when I say that it's okay, there's two issues to be distinguished here. First off, as I noted before, there's already a sufficient body of law to say that the irrevocable ordinance isn't irrevocable after all, but you'd still need to get the state to revoke it. According to Justice Scalia in Romer, because the irrevocable ordinance, as it currently exists, even if you take away the irrevocability, can only be undone by a constitutional amendment. That is, it can only be undone if polygamists can get a 2-3 majority of the state to amend the vote to amend the Constitution. That prescription as well has to fall on the majority's reasoning. This is now. Let me restate that so it's clear. Justice Scalia writes the leading dissent. He's talking about what the majority did when they decided the way they did in Romer to strike down this Colorado constitutional amendment. And Justice Scalia said if they're right, then the irrevocable ordinance is unconstitutional because it requires polygamists to get a supermajority statewide to get legal recognition for plural unions. Now, Scalia's analysis has shortcomings. Amendment 2 was framed with reference to status rather than the Colorado amendment was framed with reference to status rather than conduct. It talked about homosexuality per se rather than homosexual behavior. So the Romer decision could be distinguished on the grounds that the irrevocable ordinance in particular and anti-polygamy legislation in general have to do with conduct rather than status. Because there they're not talking about polygamy isn't a state. It's a state that occurs because you do something. And let's see. Whatever its merits, though, Justice Scalia's reasoning has not found its way into any precedential decisions. So while the above suggests that there may be jurisprudential movement toward the protection of polygamy and points to a particular line of precedent as the most likely progenitors of such protection, the foregoing should not be understood as a statement that such protection has already been achieved. Bowers remains the law of the land, and I think Reynolds stands as long as Bowers stands. Thank you.
Boy, do I feel overdressed. Came from court. I noticed that there are, maybe three of us, I say in the courtroom, three of us in this room wearing ties. I see three of us wearing ties, but only one of us has a jacket on, so I'm apologizing in advance. And you shed yours, but good idea. I'm filling in for Mary Batchelor, who wanted me to send her most profound apologies. She couldn't make it today. And I'll be a poor substitute, but I'll do the best that I can on such short notice. I think Rex did an excellent job. I think he's analyzed it in great clarity. And I think I could understand it, and if I can understand it, I'm sure everybody else could too. The last time before I did appear before a group was in the Tom Green trial when I got to testify. And that was rather fascinating and interesting because as you hear Rex talk about what the Supreme Court has mandated and the cases they've decided, and it has precedential value, I've kind of lived through it, or at least I've observed it, certainly not to the degree that Tom Green has or will, because it's not over with Tom. I'm sure won't be for a long time. But it's very interesting to be on the other side of the fence where you get to be the grillee instead of the griller on the stand and testify, and you get an entirely different perspective. I'm reminded when I see these Supreme Court decisions that perhaps there is a way for polygamists to succeed and have the Supreme Court recognize that they're very serious about this. This is more than a lifestyle. This is more than a fanciful belief system. This is something that they truly, honestly believe is a foundation for what they hope to achieve, not in this mortality, and that's why they're making all those sacrifices, but in the next. And a way to do that, if you look throughout history, it's not an easy way. It never has been for people who are true believers. I'm reminded of Gandhi, and I'm reminded of Thoreau and Emerson. And I remember a story as I was going through college where, and I don't remember if it was Thoreau or if it was Emerson. It was one of those guys who was constantly going to jail for a fancied problem that he would run across with the authorities. And if he was very upset when he saw anything that he thought was outrageous behavior on the part of the civil authorities. And so he would constantly be in jail. And one time he was in jail. Let's assume that it was Emerson this time. And Thoreau said, well, what in the world are you in jail for now? And Emerson replied, well, that isn't the question. The question is, why aren't you? And that's the same thing that applies with polygamists, sadly. And it shouldn't be that way. Rex has indicated the history that we have where we've got a lot of people who have real, true beliefs that they practice, and they practice at some penalty. And that penalty, you can see, is jail. And imagine how long it would take. And the subject of our very discussion today, how long, O Lord? Well, you know how long it's going to be until the last fundamentalist is driven out or gives up or just simply says, you know what, I'm not going to take this any longer. This is it. I'm through. I'm not going to disobey the law as far as resistance, which is the Emerson and the Gandhi approach, but I am going to stand up for my religious beliefs. And if I've got to die for them, I'm here. If I've got to go to prison for them, I'm here. You can take me. But I'm not going to give them up, period. And if there were 30,000 polygamists that sat down in the Capitol foyer, how long do you suppose it would take before the legislature recognized that these guys are fairly serious and took appropriate action? I don't think it'd take too long. And if they started arresting them, imagine the financial upheaval and the economic upheaval that would result. You first. and I believe that Mr. Gurney right here would probably do that, since I recognize him walking up and down in front of Tom Green's trial, saying what his beliefs are. But I think he's right. And I don't know that you have to broadcast it like Tom Green does. One thing I was really impressed about, and I do want to leave some time for questions. I'm sure that there's a lot of questions that need to be addressed to Rex. I was very impressed with Tom Green's wives. I've represented them against Mr. Levitt and his machinations. And if there was one consistency that was very apparent to me, that was that they were all very bright. They were all very dependent. But you know they weren't complete except as a whole. And that's kind of curious to me because that is an anomaly. How can that happen? All I want to say on the wives is that each and every one of them that I interviewed, I was convinced that they did this of their own volition. They made their own independent. And we can get into, you know, about the age, because I think that's a point well taken as well. And I'm happy to respond to questions on what my feelings are on that. I don't believe in somebody marrying polygamously at 14. I think that's wrong. But that's my own personal belief, and I'm happy to talk about that with anybody. In fact, I'd probably kill somebody that approached me and asked for my daughter for any reason at 14 years old. Be that as it may, each one of these women that I talked to are over age and very articulate. And yes, they wear clothing that is out of style 50 years ago, maybe, and their hairstyles are very plain. But they truly believe in what they're doing. And I was absolutely convinced that, as I've said about civil disobedience, if it came push to shove, each and every one of those women would have gone to prison before they testified against their husband. They shouldn't have been put in that position. And that's pretty much all I have to say. Thank you.
Idaho's, we're labeled, we're allowed to vote now and hold office, but there were a lot of non-Mormons that spent 2 years in the state pen on this cohabitation thing. You know, if you shacked up with a girl and then dropped her, and then you got married and she heard about it, she could have you arrested. And boy, you went to prison for 2 years. What?
That sounds pretty
good. Now, what about the questions? We've got a microphone. They need to be. Is that one on?
Yeah.
Oh, kind of dead.
If you do have a long question, though, if you could come up to the mic.
I'll choose you first, then.
I don't know if it's a long question or not. As it relates to rights that, say, an institutional church has in their worship, freedom of religion, is there not something there in the Constitution as it relates to the federal government cannot change impact on that particular religion? And if one were to argue that within the Mormon structure, that by changing the polygamy, and in this day and age where one is excommunicated for practicing that was, you know, supposedly legal at the time under their structure, have they not impacted and changed the Mormon religion? Is that not unconstitutional?
I'm just guessing that you read that law review article in the Stanford Law Review a couple years back. Do you remember the author's name?
I think it was a lady, wasn't it?
Yes. She's in Boston now. I don't remember. Does anybody know the article? It was a very good piece where she argued that the belief action dichotomy of Reynolds breaks down because when you force changes in action, sometimes the only way to accommodate those is by changing belief. And if you look at the course of Mormon doctrinal development over the past century, once the practice of polygamy was suppressed, well, you couldn't very well go on believing that you had to be in a plural marriage to be exalted and yet not enter into those marriages. And so the belief necessarily changed in consequence of the state regulation of action.
Is that a sound argument to go argue?
I don't think it would be conclusive for the same reason that it wouldn't work in the context of, say, blood atonement or something like that. The state won't let us kill apostates. And to the extent that we used to believe that that's what you did with an apostate, the state, by forbidding us from killing them, has forbidden us from having that belief by the same argument. And so one of the important tricks is to find a way of distinguishing what happens with you have to find a way of, for an argument like that to work, you'd have to find something that distinguishes polygamy from some of these other sorts of conduct.
I have a question from the back. Do you want to come up to the...
If
it's a short question,
it just depends on how long it is, because if it's... We have to repeat it for the mic if you don't say it into the mic.
And can I impose for just a second, if you'd bear with me? I had a little bit of a response to that because it was kind of in conjunction with what I had mentioned. In 1890, if the Mormon Church had stood fast, and it's unfair to me to look back on it because of the circumstances, except to say this, the church had all its temples taken away, all its property, it was disenfranchised. Mormons were not allowed to vote, and you look at all the Bill of Rights, the basic rights that we just assume that we've got that we can exercise and do. We had no right to vote then. If we were even suspected as a polygamist, we could take loyalty oaths, which went out with McCarthyism, and all those other things we were just simply deprived of, at least our ancestors were. And if the government can do that, it can pretty much do anything. And had the church stood firm, I believe that polygamy would probably be would be legal today.
Now, could we take your question? Will you come up and use the microphone so we don't have to repeat it?
This is kind of like a three-part question, but the primary thing I wanted to ask was, in the issue of polygamy, is it not applicable to mention the psychology behind this practice? Is it not part of a legal consideration when you think about these 13-year-old girls who are brought in, or 14-year-old? Secondly, we prosecuted the Native Americans for using peyote as part of their religious thing, but we don't want to prosecute polygamists for certain things. And also, what about that teacher who had an affair with her 13 or 14-year-old student? And she was prosecuted, and I think she was convicted. How does that differ from polygamy?
Some of the items that you mentioned, the youthful marriage, youthful marriages and things of that nature, those would be, if someone were to ask the state to justify, to provide the rational basis for its legislation, I assume that that would be part of the justification that the state would offer. They'd say the general law is rational because what we've found, as a matter of fact, is that where these kinds of practices occur, there's a tendency for these other sorts of evils to be realized. That having been said, I do think there's a lot of merit to the argument that if it's the youthful marriage problem that you're concerned with, then legislate against that. Enforce the laws that say you can't marry younger than a certain age, and repeal the statute that says that with parental consent that age gets pushed back. That is, you can deal with that problem directly without a blanket prohibition that says to consenting adults, no, you can't do this.
We have now a form of serial polygamy in our society.
I think that was commented on a good century and a half ago, in fact.
when Burton was out in Salt Lake in 1860, polygamy didn't bother him. He was from the Middle East, you know. And he said, look, two-thirds of the world, polygamy is the norm. Got a question?
You know what? We also have a form of serial monogamy. Larry King. Yeah. How many wives is he going to have? Elizabeth Taylor, how many husbands?
Serial monogamy becomes polygamy, doesn't it?
You think?
I think he may have had his hand up first. I don't. Sorry, I'm not trying to interfere.
Time is nexus. I would like to give you the foundation for my question and my background. I have 3 degrees. I study for the bar exam, and I'm preparing myself for another the patent attorney's bar exam.
So I'm sorry to hear that.
I want to bring this question also within the context of non-religion, because I'm not I don't belong to any religion now at this time, or an atheist. I'm not an atheist, but I don't belong to any membership or religion. And I want to bring it as their civil liberties and the bigamy laws in the Constitution of the United States. That's my foundation. I want to present a different stream of lifestyle. There's the religious lifestyle, and then there's the lifestyle of Mr. Hugh Hefner. And in a magazine called Vanity Fair, he said that monogamy was an experiment in his life. And he also mentions that, is polygamy the answer? He smiles. Well, I think it's one of the answers. There's no single answer. The answer is, don't be so judgmental of people who have other answers than yours. I assume that Mr. Heffner is the most successful.
You're not going to show us any pictures from that, are you?
No. This is Tycoon Magazine. Is for the Tycoon Magazine. Very wealthy people, basically, I believe that Mr. Hugh Heffner is the most successful defender of polygamy in the United States history, just by those statements here. And also by presenting himself, this is a PG-14 picture of Mr. Heffner. He's still married. He has one wife, Kimber, and separated from her, two children, 14 years old. And he has seven steady girlfriends. He asked permission from each one of their parents to spouse them.
Can you move to a question?
Yes, and also they exchange gifts. My question then is this. As a United States citizen in Utah, I want personally, I'm not responding to my question for myself, I want to invoke equal protection under the law derived from Mr. Hugh Heffner as a United States citizen in California. And I also want equal footing, not just for states, but I want to stretch the interpretation, just like Mr. Levitt did it with several laws. I want to stretch the interpretation of equal footing for citizens. As a United States citizen in Utah, I want to have equal footing with the United States citizen in California named Hugh Heffner.
Okay.
In terms of civil liberties.
So
it's not polygamy. This is a picture of polygamy without religion and a polygamy without pornography, because I don't want to bring pornography on the question, and there's no smut. I just want to present his lifestyle with his seven steady.
Can I respond?
Duly noted.
Sure, absolutely.
Duly noted. And the response I would make is that that's an interesting point that you make about Hugh Heffner, because you know what? Never in this world is he ever going to be charged. It isn't going to happen. On the other hand, if he raised the mantle of polygamy as an issue that he believed in, he'd go to jail like all the rest. So he can get away with it. For some reason, society will close their eyes to all kinds of immoral behavior like Hugh Heffner's, and that's okay. That's acceptable. That's mainstream. But as soon as you say, I'm doing this because I really believe in it, and I'm going to provide for these women, and in a religious context, you go to jail.
Just a historical note, that sort of reasoning actually was considered in the 19th century during some of the congressional debates over the polygamy legislation, and the observation that was made is there's a difference between, and this isn't entirely applicable to the case of Hugh Heffner, but the observation that was made in the Congress is there's a difference between sneaking around all these different women's houses and sort of shoving it in people's faces, hi, this is what I'm doing. Now, the interesting thing about Heffner is that he seems to fall into that latter category. So
can I keep my...
No, can we please move on?
Sure, sure.
Thank you.
30 seconds.
Okay, thank you for your time.
Thank you. We'll let you run over a little.
Thank you. I heard you say that one of the arguments for a law against plural marriage was that society would be protected. A law is made to protect society. My question is, what is society being protected from? Polygamy. My other question is, also laws are made on a rational basis. What is the rational basis for laws against plural marriage when it's done with consenting adults? Also, plural marriage has no victims. I agree with your argument that if there's underage girls being married, that is what needs to be addressed. Those laws need to be enforced. But when it comes to consenting adults, so my questions are, what are we trying to protect society from with laws against plural marriage? What is the rational basis? And where are the victims with consenting adults?
Okay, if it's okay, I'll start from the back and work forward. With respect to, well, actually, and your second and third questions can be treated together. The question of what's the rational basis, and given that this is a victimless crime, what's the problem? Bowers v. Hardwick said, first off, rational basis can just be moral distaste. To a majority of the voters' definition, if a majority of the voters find this morally offensive, that's a, or whomever, that's a, what's that?
Similar to the obscenity laws
and quite similar to the anti-sodomy laws at issue in Bowers v. Hardwick. And so moral offense can constitute rational basis even where it's a victimless crime. Bowers decided that squarely on. So whether you like the what's that?
Bedroom.
Even in the bedroom. That case, that issue was put squarely before the court in Bowers, and what the court said is, yeah, it's good enough. It's also worth noting that in the Romer v. Evans dissent that I just mentioned, Justice Scalia's big shtick, which you can certainly count on Rehnquist and Thomas supporting him with, is that what are at issue here are cultural wars that are to be fought in the political arena, not in the courts. And so his solution would be, if you think you've got enough of a case here, good, take it to the people and get a law passed. But the courts ain't going to help you with a cultural war. That's Scalia's position, at least, and that was the dominant sort of view in the Bowers v. Hardwick decision. Now, in terms of the protection of the public from things, even the Bowers minority said that all we're talking about is protecting what people do in the privacy of their own homes. If it's a public sort of thing, then we're not talking about that, and so that's why I said Tom Green would be out of luck even if the Bowers minority had carried the day.
I'd like to thank you all for your coming. Our session is a little over time, and we will have to vacate for the next one. Thank you.
Thanks.
Nice to meet you.